Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann. Last week, candidates running for Ohio governor turned in their campaign finance reports. And one thing is clear. Republicans have raised more money than Democrats. A lot more. On the GOP side, the four Republican candidates, Attorney General Mike DeWine, Secretary of State John Husted, U.S. Rep. Jim Renacci, and Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor have raised a total of nearly $13.8 million. Democrats, by comparison, have little more than $1.5 million. We're talking about the governor's race in 2018 and other state news this hour on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Balmert. Welcome, Jesse. Nice to see you.
Hello.
Public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch, Daryl Rowland. Daryl, nice to see you. Welcome.
Good morning, Gail.
And bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Welcome to all of you. Thank you.
Great to be here.
I haven't seen you all for about a year, so it's nice to be back in the room with you again.
It's not quite Wags and Elliot, but hey.
I won't divert too much, but they celebrated their 40th and with a big party Saturday night, so we saw a lot of the old crew.
Oh, great.
So Husted has raised more than $2 million, DeWine about $1.2. Perhaps the biggest news, though, came from Congressman Jim Renacci. He loaned his campaign $4 million. Now, not very many people can do that, but he did. So many people are interested in this job so early to me, and that is what struck me, the large number of people throwing their hat in the ring for the 2018 campaign. Are you all surprised at that?
Not really, in a sense, because, I mean, you certainly had, especially on the Republican side, a lot of Republicans with nowhere to go. I mean, they're term limited in terms of the offices they occupy. I mean, that's not the case for Jim Renacci, who's a congressman and could run again. But, you know, Mary Taylor, Mike DeWine, John Husted, they are term limited in those offices. So where do you go? Well, you look to another higher office, it seems, for a lot of people. And, you know, the Senate race, I'm surprised there wasn't more interest in the Senate race because right now there are two Republicans in it, Josh Mandel, a treasurer, the state treasurer, who is term limited, and also a Cleveland area man named Mike Gibbons, who's a venture capitalist. But in a way, I'm not really surprised because where else were they? If they wanted to continue to serve in government, they wanted to be reelected to or elected to another position. Governor's the highest office in the state, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. And also because John Kasich was running for president much of 2015 and part of 2016, I think it gave Republicans a little bit of room to perhaps talk about their next steps earlier than they would have edgewise. And then also there are a number of Democrats who are interested in this position, currently four, maybe five, or maybe even more. And I think that's just we've had 2 years of a Republican or two terms of a Republican governor. And so Democrats are saying, hey, it's our turn.
And now that surprises me to see four people already who have expressed interest on the Democratic side in running and for people who really aren't well known. And
right. I don't know them, but, you know, we're here in Central Ohio. So if you're not from their area, they're kind of unknown.
And of course, the one that's still out there is Richard Cordray, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, who reports seem to indicate that he's going to announce somewhere around Labor Day that he's going to run. So that's been the one that some folks have been waiting on. But that remains to be seen if he's going to do it.
Daryl?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, that's one consequence of term limits. They reach the end of their term. They have no place else to go. And certainly for Attorney General Mike DeWine, of course, this would be the capstone of his career, long political career. For Secretary of State John Husted, you know, he's much younger. As we just saw last week, he is a very good fundraiser as well. This is something to which he has aspired. And Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, some would say it's a natural step up. And I think Congressman Renacci is clearly trying to follow the Donald Trump playbook. Again, this Ohio will be an interesting experiment to whether anyone but Donald Trump can follow the Donald Trump playbook. But we're going to find out because Jim Renacci seems to be doing that.
He has a lot of the same attributes, thought processes, platform issues.
And one thing I keep hearing about is that Jerry Springer is considering running for governor.
I really did hear that, but I didn't think it was factual.
I've actually gotten calls from people who claim to have some knowledge of this, which is just amazing. Because, you know, a lot of us talked to Jerry Springer over the last year because he was at the Democratic Convention. And you know, being from Ohio, he has a show that he does down in the Cincinnati area. And he had not, he'd said he wasn't going to run. He was too old. He was, you know. And then there was, after Trump was elected, it seemed he might have changed his mind about public office. For a while, it looked like he might be interested in running for Congress. But I've also heard governor, which is just really, I guess there's an attitude of if Donald Trump can be elected, then anybody can be elected. Is that right?
I guess that's true. But I know my colleagues have reached out to him. Obviously, yeah. He's a former mayor of Cincinnati, and he said repeatedly no, that this isn't something that he's interested in. Of course, everybody says they're not interested until they're interested. But I think he is somebody that some Democrats have been interested in just because he has that kind of tell it like it is demeanor. And obviously that worked well for the president. But also for can Jim Renacci follow the exact path of Donald Trump? I think he can't because he doesn't have near the name recognition certainly has a lot of personal wealth, but probably not near the personal wealth as Donald Trump. And so I think where Donald Trump walked in with immediate name recognition, Jim Renacci, some people still don't know how to pronounce his last name. So I think that's going to be a huge difference. And certainly name recognition can be made up with money. I mean, just ask Rob Portman, but he cannot run the same race.
And I don't think Jim Renacci is well known outside of the Northeast Ohio area
where
he serves.
But he can pay to be well known.
That's true. And he certainly has more money, personal money, than the other candidates in this race. Mike DeWine also lent his campaign about $1 million. So Renacci certainly comes in with a lot more money. But, you know, in a four-way race, that would take a lot of money to buy the name recognition that he would need to beat somebody. For instance, Mike DeWine. People have known Mike DeWine for years, and I think he comes into this with that. That's one definite thing he comes into this race with is name recognition. But then the other candidates have other things that they're bringing as well.
I think, Gail, one of the wild card here, though, especially concerning Congressman Renacci, does President Trump personally get involved in this? Don't forget, and you know, well, you think, well, why would he? Don't forget, this is the then president-elect got involved in the selection of the Ohio Republican Party chairman, seemingly, you know, a smaller role, if you will, although that's important to a president to have your loyalist in place. But he probably would like a loyalist Ohio governor, some might say for once, in place. So if Donald Trump gets in and says, you know, I really like this Jim Renacci guy.
That could change the game.
That really would be a game changer, yes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan in for Ann this week. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. If you have a question or comment, please give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Karen, you brought up the contender in the Democratic race, Richard Cordray, director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, former attorney general in Ohio. So he does have name recognition statewide.
And former
here.
State treasurer, as a matter of fact,
and
too.
Former state treasurer. Are you hearing in Democratic circles that he is thinking about it? Because apparently he can't talk about it and where he is in his position.
Oh, yeah. I think it's been reported as well as rumored before it was reported that he was interested. And like I said, that I'm hearing Labor Day will be the time that he'll make the announcement. I mean, I talked to Ohio Supreme Court Justice Bill O'Neill, who had said that he was interested in running but decided not to run because he said that Cordray is definitely in. And then that's, you know, just one example of the kind of stories that are going on behind the scenes. I think, you know, in a way, it would be a really great thing for Cordray if he got fired by President Trump as head of the CFPB, because that could really jumpstart not only his name recognition, but also his fundraising among not only people in Ohio, but people outside of Ohio who would feel that this was a real partisan shot. And I don't know whether – I think that's the question now. And there was even an article over the weekend about does he wait for Trump to fire him or does he get into the race?
And about that firing and being at odds with Congress, what is the impetus for them wanting to get rid of him?
Well, Republicans have hated this agency since day one. And they fought and fought to keep it from being created.
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right. There was a great struggle over Rich Cordray himself being nominated to the post, mainly because people opposed the agency. And people, I'm saying like Republicans in Congress, opposed the agency so ardently, saying it has too much power and things of that nature. So a lot of them said, it's nothing personal against Rich Cordray, but we're going to oppose it. So Obama, long story short, got the appointment through. Now that Mr. Cordray's been in office for, 4 years or so? Now they're starting to hate the agency even more because Rich has been kind of an activist there. And, you know, there's no Democrats much of any place else who can do much of anything. By statute, his term went beyond the presidential transition. So it does not expire till roughly a year from now. A political dynamic, of course, if he would wait till that long, that's much too late to get in the governor's race. But he's made people mad. Most recently, he's proposed allowing class action lawsuits against banks. Right now, a lot of us don't know it. If you read the fine print when you sign up, get a bank account or whatever, you are agreeing not to sue them, but to go through an arbitration process instead as an alternative. And since you can't get an account without agreeing to that, the opponents say that's forced arbitration. Rich Cordray wants to change that. He wants to allow class action suits. And again, he cites the latest bad boy on the block, if you will, Wells Fargo, for all the abuses it's done. I said, you know, these guys deserve, the people who have been wrong with this deserve to have their day in court, not just some private arbitration process where they may or may not, be made whole.
Yes, and please. I was just going to add that some of this came out, too. Corey Lewandowski, who was a Trump advisor, and he spoke at the City Club of Cleveland last week, was asked specifically in national media and then at the City Club about this issue and about his involvement in the governor's race. And, you know, he made a comment about how on Meet the Press, I think it was, that Trump should fire Rich Cordray. And he was asked then, you know, what's your involvement here? Are you involved with any sort of agency that would be covered by the CFPB? And are you involved with the governor's race at all? And it turns out both of those things are the case. He actually does some work with, I think, payday lenders. And
although then, he denied that initially.
He did deny that initially. That's right. And then he also is involved with the Renacci campaign. So that speaks to Daryl's point earlier about how involved will President Trump be in the governor's race in Ohio. Well, certainly Corey Lewandowski is still close to the president and his people. So that implies that maybe there is an interest by Trump in what's going to happen in the governor's race in Ohio.
And after the City Club event, he had a fundraiser for Renacci, so that was another thing. But also this bureau was kind of the brainchild of Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is progressive, and obviously congressional Republicans are no particular fan of her. But as many Republicans would like to see him out of this, there are some people whispering in the president's ear saying, hey, keep him in there until 2018. That would keep him from running for governor in Ohio. So there's a bit of tension there.
In fact, I think the Ohio Republican Party has sent that message fairly explicitly to President Trump saying, you know, don't make this guy a martyr. We'd rather run against the other four. And, of course, we haven't even mentioned the names of the other four yet.
Right. If he has the name recognition, other four.
Right. Joe Schiavone, Nan Whaley,
still nameless.
Connie Palish, right, and former Congresswoman Betty Sutton. Again, we talk about Renacci, no name ID. None of those folks really have name ID. Connie Palish was on the statewide ballot, but for state treasurer, she had the virtue of being the Democrat coming the closest to winning a statewide race back in 2014. But I don't know. What is the old saying that? And a buck will get you a cup of something or other these days. Probably $5 now, right?
It's going to be interesting. I still think as a if you are just a voter in Ohio, you look at this and think, this is really an early start with so much talk about an early start. And people throw their hats in the ring and take them out just as quickly. And that doesn't seem to be happening this time.
Not yet. I think there's a possibility. I mean, I would think that if Cordray got in, because so many people have focused on him, that there might be some Democrats who might step aside. And fundraising is going to be a big deal, I think. Like you started the show by saying, the Republicans have raised a lot more money than Democrats. And, you know, if Democrats can't pull in the kind of money they're going to need, might they consider not running this time. There's always that possibility.
Well, and right, on the Democratic side, there's certainly still apparently some down ticket slots to be filled. And I think it's expected that the field will sort of sort itself out, certainly on the Democratic side. And some of those candidates who will fall short for governor will be running for state auditor or something like that. The other thing you have to remember is, you know, we think next year, next November, whatever, these are primary contests. So we're talking about May of next year. So that's not all that far away.
We're
9 months out. And in terms of organizing a state campaign, getting the money and all that to run a successful campaign, and as we're seeing, it's going to be a very expensive proposition on the Republican side for sure. It's not that long of time in political terms.
And capping how much money they spent, that's a discussion for another day.
Well, I'd also add, too, that since Jim Renacci is running, that opens up his seat. And so there's been a lot of interest in that seat. I think we've got two candidates in that seat right now in that race, Christina Hagan, state representative, and Tom Patton, right?
Yes.
State senator, now representative.
Yes.
They go so quickly. It's
well,
hard to keep track.
They go back and forth.
They switch
you know?
A lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one to keep an eye on, too, because certainly, you know, typically who wins the primary in the congressional races wins the general based on who's won the seat. I mean, and those votes have been very, very lopsided in terms of if you are a Democrat, you're one of the four Democrats in Congress from Ohio, you won by big margins. If you're one of the 12 Republicans in Congress from Ohio, you won by those by big margins. So who wins that primary in Renacci's seat could potentially win that seat. And, you know, it looks like it's a Republican area right now.
We will continue our conversation in just a moment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. Five health insurance companies are stepping up to sell Obamacare exchange plans to 19 Ohio counties that would have been left in the lurch next year. The county exchanges were left with no insurers after two companies pulled out in recent months. The state has reached tentative agreements with five other companies to cover all but one remaining county, Paulding, and that's in Northwest Ohio. That's the good news for folks on the exchange, but filings show that insurance companies in the exchange will seek big premium hikes next year, some as high as 20%. We're talking about that and other state news on our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Democratic, or rather state government reporter from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Ballmer. Jesse, nice to see you. Public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch, Daryl Rowland, and bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Karen Kessler. Welcome again to all of you. Jesse, you covered this. What's going on? I mean, it sounds like good news for Ohioans.
Yeah, Department of Insurance came out with this early last week saying, you know, we're going to cover these 19 counties and five different insurers have stepped up to do this. There was really a lot of question about whether this would happen, especially after Anthem left. Anthem was like really the big fish in the insurance pool in Ohio. And then there was also a Dayton-based Premier Health Plan that left as well. And so there was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen in 2018 when those two insurers were no longer in the exchange. And it was also a talking point for people discussing healthcare at the federal level, saying, well, look at poor Ohio here. It's got 19 to 20 counties without even an option. This is either an example of Obamacare failing or negotiations about the replacement for Obamacare failing, depending on which side you're on, per se. And so Department of Insurance was obviously working with these companies to come up with a solution. This appears to be the solution. But as you alluded to, I mean, it could be a pricey solution for some people.
How many people did it affect when there was no insurance coverage until these other companies stepped forward?
So there were going to be about 11,000 Ohioans that were going to be left without an option on the state's healthcare exchange. And so that was a concern. A lot of them were more rural counties, and so they didn't have a lot of options to begin with. And so losing Anthem was a big blow. And so the state has, you know, worked with these five insurers to kind of spread out and provide at least one option.
So why did Anthem and another one, Premier Health, pull out?
So Anthem, in their statement, said they were very concerned about the uncertainty in the market. One of the things they talked about were these subsidies that insurers are provided to provide insurance to lower-income people. And these have been tied up in court because congressional Republicans basically sued, saying that Obama could not have given these allowed for these subsidies without their approval. And so they sued over that, and the court, I believe, actually sided with them. And the Obama administration presumably was planning to appeal, but then Donald Trump won the White House. And so there's this uncertainty as to, I mean, since President Trump and congressional Republicans are on the same side, presumably they aren't going to appeal this decision. And so these subsidies, which insurers really count on to make it affordable for them to provide this insurance, are kind of in limbo right now.
And the ones that, excuse me, did step forward, are they decent, well-known health insurance companies that are probably going to be able to help these folks?
I mean, they're all names that you've seen in Ohio insurance before. You have CareSource, Buckeye Health Plan, Medical Mutual, Molina, and Paramount Healthcare. So...
Yeah,
presumably,
hopefully.
Yes.
Yeah, presumably. Oh, now, just, was it a week ago, Daryl, that you were at the rally in West Virginia where Trump spoke?
Right.
Did he mention any of this about repealing Obamacare, about health care in general?
He did, although at that point it was just sort of a checklist, if you will. He didn't go into it that much. But he talked about, and he was clearly in the, not just repeal, but repeal and replace, and puts the onus totally on Republicans in Congress, saying, you know, my pen is ready. You need to end the disaster of Obamacare, as he puts it, and get me an alternative to my desk. I'm ready to sign it. So he's obviously not taking any leadership in terms of proposing anything or saying, I like idea A and this part of plan B, and let's do it that way. He's saying, you guys do it, and I'll sign it. So he is doing that. Most of the time in West Virginia, frankly, and we went to West Virginia, it's in Huntington, it's, you know, just across the river from Chesapeake, Ohio, South Point, the far extreme south of the Buckeye State. Most of that was condemning, perhaps in the strongest terms yet, the whole investigation of his campaign's relationship with Russia and the Russians back in 2016, mostly.
It sounded like a campaign rally, actually, from what I was able to hear and read about.
Having covered many campaign rallies, it was pretty much the same thing. Even to the point, this arena held, I think, 9,000 in the stands, and then they had seats on the floor. So there's, I'm sure, a good 12,000, 13,000 at least there. But it was very much, it was actually the exact same setup they did in whatever Riverfront calls it, U.S. Bank Arena, I think it is now, in Cincinnati. Exactly the same for the campaign. The warm-up music was the same. The signs were the same. And the people I talked to were kind of the same. I asked, well, as far as, yeah, we've heard about this Russian stuff, but we really don't think there's anything to it. And there's just kind of an unwillingness to believe that. They think it's concocted, whether by Democrats, by the media, or by what have you, Trump's enemies, if you will. So I guess maybe you'd expect this at a Trump rally, but, you know, he's pulling in the big campaign-style crowds. Not like Huntington's a metropolis, so he's pulling in people from all around that neck of the woods, the tri-state area down there.
And I was on vacation last week and traveled through West Virginia the day after he had his rally, and there definitely appears to be a fair amount of support for Trump even today. I remember my son pointed out to me a billboard that said it was an injury lawyer firm. Injured? Call the lawyers that supported Donald Trump. I mean, so there's still a lot of support, I think, in that area for him. And obviously the West Virginia governor was there on stage and switched parties, though he's been a registered Republican since 2015.
Right, yeah.
Well, but still, a Democratic governor saying he's a Republican now, it could be.
Well, right. And this makes 34 Republican governors in the country. And Democrats have 15. And there's one independent.
And that's the impact. I mean, even though he has been a registered Republican since 2015, which is what a lot of Democrats have been saying, that this isn't that big a deal. It is a big deal when you consider that number. And when Democrats are trying to win more states and trying to, you know, improve their ground game and going into 2018, that hurts.
Now, the interesting thing, this is happening, you know, I'm talking about the great popularity, and the crowd was one of the most enthusiastic I've ever seen for Trump, and I don't know, I've been at least a dozen events for him. At the same time, the national poll numbers continue to go down. Quinnipiac University's poll last week, I think it was a 33% approval rating, and perhaps most significant, if you look within the data, again, this is just 1 month, so it's a snapshot, but the almost the legendary group that everyone cites as helping Mr. Trump win last year, the white voters who do not have a college education, even now a majority of those disapprove, a majority of plurality, most more disapprove than approve, I'll put it that way. And that's the first time that threshold has slipped with that group that's been very supportive so far.
So his base is slipping a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, he can still pack an arena. He can still, you know, get people to write letters to the editor or send us all fun emails or whatever. But, you know, if we're to, and now, you know, anytime a poll is against them, they say it's a fake poll. If it's for them, it's a good poll.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. Again, joining me, Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Daryl Rowland, Columbus Dispatch public affairs editor, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Change the subject. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in town.
Can I add one more thing real quick?
Go, Karen.
Real quick.
Yeah.
As we talk about the ACA repeal and Donald Trump,
yes.
I think there's this movement that continues to be talked about Kasich running for president. I mean, we talked about it at the beginning, whether what Kasich's going to do. There seems to be this interest in maybe him being a candidate who could potentially primary Trump if Trump is still wants to run or is even in a position to run in 2020. And so, you know, to see Kasich yesterday on Face the Nation with the Democratic governor of Colorado talking about what they feel like they can do in terms of the ACA repeal and some sort of a bipartisan solution, this continues Kasich's whole public relations strategy on this. He's been doing this all year and now reaching out to a Democrat to join him. You know, he didn't offer a whole lot of solutions in that, but still he's out there talking. And there are certainly folks who read that as he is interested in either running for president in 2020, challenging Trump in the primary, challenging Mike Pence in the primary, whoever is there. He wants to be there.
And, you know, he really is part of a fairly impressive bipartisan movement. Now, again, they're just saying this bipartisan group has not really done anything more than say we should be bipartisan about it. But, you know, we've got several governors from each party, including Terry McAuliffe, who's the former Democratic National Committee chairman, signing on with John Kasich, with other Republican governors, with other Democratic governors, such as Governor Hickenlooper from Colorado. So it's an interesting accomplishment. You know, you do almost wonder, well, what do you got to lose in Washington? Why not listen to what these folks are saying, especially on things like Medicaid expansion, because it's being carried out at the state level.
Well, if nothing else, I think politically it looks good for them because people have been saying we want people to work together. So this is at least trying to prove that there is an effort, and maybe they think that appeals to many voters.
Well, and I think that the governors are showing that, my gosh, this is the Washington disease, and the governors are closer to the people. When you got, you know, leaders in Congress saying, by golly, we better get together and pass this, because if we don't, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go work with the other side, by golly. And let's use this as a threat, as a brickbat to pound somebody over the head. And, you know, we back here in flyover country saying, isn't that what they're supposed to be doing? Wasn't compromise part of that civics and all that learning? One more thing on Governor Kasich in politics. I haven't even written this for the Dispatch. I'll probably get in trouble. So it's an all-size exclusive. Governor Kasich is considering several opportunities, speaking opportunities in, guess where, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, I covered him. It's been 2 years ago. So that means they're going to be back in another year or so. people go to that state, first primary in the nation, presumably it will still be when it comes to cycle. And you talk about getting ready early. You've got to.
I think for Kasich, too, it's not just political interest here in terms of why he talks about bipartisan solutions and that sort of thing. I mean, if indeed the solution is to basically turn a lot of this cost over to the states, this would cost Ohio a lot of money because Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, when 700,000 people now have Medicaid under the expansion, that the state would have to pick up that tab for, and that's billions of dollars. It would blow a huge hole in the state budget. So I think while he's certainly got political aspirations and I think he wants to work maybe across the aisle, the idea that this could really hurt Ohio is a serious issue.
And I think anytime anybody visits New Hampshire or Iowa, I mean, didn't Tim Ryan take a trip or he's going to take a trip, as somebody writes an article saying, well, are they going to run for president in 2020? So, I mean, certainly being part of this conversation for the governor is both good for Ohio and good for him politically, getting his name recognition up and just having that relevance in this discussion. But also the Republican Party is going to be looking for a conservative and a Republican. And being the Republican that Democrats love is perhaps not going to work in a primary. So we'll see.
We have a caller. Hello, are you there, Mark? See, I'm probably not doing this right.
Hello.
Oh, there's Hi, Mark. There.
We got gotcha.
Mark.
I'm sorry.
At any rate.
Mark from Clintonville, your comment, please.
Yes. Quite honestly, people need to take a close look at Kasich's record. The man is no conservative. He's as far to the right as to come. If you look at issues of abortion, women's health, labor law, the environment, he's as far to the right as they come in terms of Republicans, and that's all I have to say.
Mark, thank you.
And that is something a lot of Democrats will tell you, that he talks a good game about bipartisanship on national media and that he's not really challenged on his record in terms of how he has worked with Democrats in the state and that he has, like Mark was suggesting, the Senate Bill 5, the labor union ballot issue and you know, some of these other things. He's very, very anti-abortion and a lot of clinics have closed. And so Democrats will point to this and say he's not nearly the compassionate conservative that he may be portraying himself on television.
We will see where this goes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to defend him, but there's arguments on the other side with the Medicaid expansion, mental health funding. And it's just, Jesse's right. In a Republican primary, he's going to be viewed as a lefty almost.
Yeah.
The caller is also right on the entire political spectrum. There's no question he is a political conservative, mm-hmm. or at least what a political conservative used to be in this country.
But he appears to be one of these people that, while being a conservative in the Republican Party, isn't afraid to go against some of the Republican Party people that are within the party, be it in Ohio or nationwide. And he will go against the norm.
From time to time, yes.
Yeah.
Ask Ohio lawmakers.
But I think there are still voters who are – Republican voters who are angry with Kasich, who disapprove of his decision, you know, not to support Trump, not to go to the Republican convention in Cleveland last year. You know, To expand Medicaid, to do some of the things like Daryl was just saying. I think there are some voters who are going to see him, like Jesse said, is just, you know, he's a rhino, is the Republican in name only, you know.
Okay, Attorney General Jeff Sessions in town last week in a speech that harkened back to the 1980s war on drugs. He announced the administration's plan to fight the nation's opioid epidemic. He primarily focused on locking up those who improperly hand out prescription painkillers. Let's take a listen.
If you're a doctor illegally prescribing opioids for profit, or a pharmacist letting these pills walk out the door onto the streets based on prescriptions you know are obtained under false pretenses, we're coming after you.
So the federal government taking a stronger stand on cracking down on prescription drugs. But Ohio already has taken an aggressive approach to this and seen results. Am I right?
Yeah, that's my colleague Marty Schladen covered that event for us. And he came back and, you know, he's a newer guy, but he starts laying all this out, what the Attorney General Sessions said. And my colleagues have covered this drug war for years and years, and I sort of looked at each other and it's like, kind of been there, done that here in Ohio. You're a little late to the party here. Now, again, we talked to people who said that, but, you know, no one's going to turn up their nose at, you know, hey, extra help, another prosecutor, and, hey, more money. And no one's going to say that's bad, but, you know, we've kind of moved on. And, in fact, there's a bit of irony here. Ohio's crackdown on the pill mills and the docks like that has driven many people to heroin because you can't get the pills in Ohio. So it's like, we've done the crackdown. Now we're on to the first part of that problem. And he didn't talk a whole lot specifically about heroin, fentanyl, carfentanil, things that are really plaguing this state right now.
We are going to continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Back with All Sides. We've been discussing about the fact that Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in town last week talking about the war on drugs, specifically opioid epidemic here in Ohio. And Daryl, you already talked about the fact that Ohio is doing some of the suggested topics that Sessions brought up. So if Ohio is already doing a commendable job, what can the federal government offer?
Well, the big problem in states that are the hardest hit like Ohio, seems to be lack of beds, lack of treatment. That was one of the critiques of Governor Kasich's budget this year. The House and then the Senate voted to add some more money for treatment. And I think, boy, to catch up with the needs out there when this is just crushing us. I mean, over 4,000 dead last year. We led the nation. All signs are that it's going to be another big increase this year. We could be, or certainly going to be near, if we're not at the top of the nation. Somebody's got to get a handle on that.
Did Sessions offer money? Did it mention any kind of federal aid?
Oh, there's some grant money and things of that nature. And ironically, there's, you know, some of the local enforcement effort is already funded by federal grants. But I didn't hear anything. Frankly, the proposal wasn't very specific in terms of laying out, you know, we're going to do A, B, C, and D for all states, including Ohio. They did offer an extra prosecutor, an extra federal prosecutor for the Southern District of Ohio, which essentially is south of I-70. So I think that'll be welcome. But again, that was supposed to target the pill mills and all that are, you can always do more, but I'm not sure that's where the main need. If you would survey people around the state, local officials who are on the front lines of this problem, I don't think they would list that as their number one need. We just need to kind of get ahead of this, because the only hope for something that gets a grip on you, like the heroin or fentanyl, if you survive it, you know, you really need some intense treatment, and it's not cheap, and you fail a lot the first time. So it's an amazing effort that's required.
Would you say that there's no teeth in what he brought to the table? Just more of an acknowledgement of, yes, this is here. We know about it, but nothing more of what to do about it. And to your point, no offer of money, grant money, whatever, for the treatment of it, which is where we need to be apparently right now.
Well, I think there was teeth, but it's in the prosecution of the pill mill. So you're sort of saying, we're going to help you with that problem you dealt with 4 years ago or whatever. Again, I'm not saying that problem has gone away. And again, everyone would like more help. But if you want to get right where the contemporary part of the problem is, where it's evolving on the front lines, they should be doing something like, you know, okay, this is an epidemic that the heroin epidemic has kind of bypassed the black community. You know, unlike the you talk about the 1980s and the 90s, you know, the crack versus cocaine, but the crack that devastated a lot of poor black neighborhoods. But now, your drug dealers are mixing in fentanyl with drugs that are more prevalent in the black neighborhood and getting blacks hooked on heroin, hooked on this nasty stuff as well. Well, how about a front lines effort to stop that? You know, the one community that ironically, although poor, just like rural poor, had not been affected quite as much, but now is.
ECOT, I was here last year at this time subbing for Ann, and we were talking about ECOT, and we're still talking about ECOT.
You'll be here this time, and we'll be talking about ECOT. Maybe.
That online charter school, okay, they've already agreed, they have to pay back $60 million. I'm not sure if they've really agreed.
Well, they haven't agreed to that,
But that's what the state is saying that they have to do. So now ECOT faces a 12% funding cut because officials suspect the school saw a drop in enrollment last year. And yet they are fighting that, and I think that probably ECOT is trying still to do things in the court system that would stop that. But the latest with the payback issue is they're going to be asking for more. The state is going to ask for more. Or is that – at this point they're questioning whether they should ask for more.
Well, the state has a monthly payment that goes to ECOT based on their full-time enrollment, as they report it. The state started trimming that back. It's $8.1 million a month. The state started trimming that back by $2.5 million. And then this on top of it, 12.5% reduction on top of that, because the thought is that ECOT owes the state $60 million for a two-year period of – well, there was the one school year where they had overestimated their student enrollment by 9,000 students as determined by the Ohio Department of Education and various court cases. ECOT says that's not the case. They're still litigating and want to go to the Ohio Supreme Court. Right now, they're paying back the $60 million that they owe the state. But now the state is looking forward and saying – we still have no confidence that you are reporting your full-time enrollment as you should be, and so we're going to keep pulling back money till we are confident in the level that you're reporting your students at. So this is very, ECOT is kind of on both sides of this, saying this could send them into a death spiral where they would not recover and have to close. And they've also made some staff reductions and some layoffs, but they've also been telling people that we're not going to close. We're going to fight on. We're going to continue. So I that's why I joked that a year from now we may be sitting here talking about this. But charter schools are audited every 5 years. ECOT is now being audited every year until this is dealt with, and so. That's why I feel like you might be talking about this even next year.
Even next year. Well, is there a question that ECOT may not survive, which you brought up? One of the reasons why the state wants to try to get their hands on money now, or if there at least is money there?
I think that's a reasonable assumption. And this was sort of sparked by Auditor Dave Yost asking the Department of Education to consider this, which itself I think was sparked by one of our stories, my colleague Bill Bush, if I'm remembering the right story. It's hard to sort these things out. We're talking about three different school years. The $60 million payment that's already been decided by the school board is for 2015-16. The school year that just ended, 2016-17, would have just ended, when people graduate in June. That is still being audited. ECOT claimed for that year basically the same attendance level that was found to be false for the previous year. Now we're into 2017-2018 school year, the one that just started this summer. And again, they're claiming the old level, what the state contended was an inflated level. So you're paying back $60 million for 1 year. When the state finishes its audit of last school year, there could be tens of millions more due back. And now you're making virtually the same claims again, and you're just digging the hole deeper and deeper and deeper. And, you're over... who knows? Maybe over $100 million or whatever. So I think they do want to. What's the old saying? If you're if you're in a hole, stop digging. Because all this is state money. The legal dispute. We're paying for the state's attorney. We're in the state audit. We're paying for ECOT's attorney and all that. We're paying the Supreme Court justices. So
and all
every
the year,
move we're paying for.
And all the years before this audit. Where, you could make the argument that did ECOT have as many students as they reported? If you started to go back into the founding of ECOT years ago, the argument goes that this could be a very big pot of money that the state may never get back. But, the question ECOT still has said that they want resolved is whether the school board was correct in making this determination and how do you really count students full time online when you can't see them in a classroom? What's the best way to measure that they're actually getting the learning opportunities that the state is paying for? And so that's what's ahead, I guess.
And this is important not only because of the money attached to this, as Daryl and Karen have talked about, but also ECOD is no small player in charter schools in Ohio. And I mean, a lot of Republicans have received money from them as far as campaign donations over the years. They've certainly helped craft a lot of the laws that have gone into place for this particular industry. And I just think, you know, it's an important group in the conversation about charter schools in Ohio.
I mean, here you have Dave Yost, who's now speaking out against ECOT, but he has actually spoken at ECOT graduation. So it shows that, you know, there are close ties to Republicans in office. He's not the only one. House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, other people
have all received donations
and
from
have spoken
the
at owner these graduations.
ECOT.
And yes. And so they're definitely, Jesse's right, there's definitely a longstanding relationship between Republican leadership and ECOT. Founder Bill Lager.
As my colleague Jim Siegel reported, even as Mr. Lager and others cry that we may be facing doom with ECOT, where we run out of money and all that, he and one of his top aides found over $120,000 personally to make campaign contributions. Now, the Ohio Republican Party has given back their chunk of it. And they won't really say why. It's just sort of in the best interest of the party. And the other thing, Jesse's right, it's more than dollar and cents. How about kids who may not be getting an education here? The whole argument for things like charter schools, school choice, is that the conventional system of traditional public schools is failing us. You know, kids, especially the big urban districts, you know, they're not getting educated. They need competition, and let's give parents a choice. All that's well and good. But you compare, say, a big urban district like Columbus, who has a 70-something graduation rate. Not that good, of course. ECOTS is only about half of that after, some 15, 16 years of existence. So no question that some people bring help. Some people need that non-traditional learning environment. But, you know, you're doing it on our dime, folks. So there needs to be some accountability. And there's a moral issue here, too, of are we really educating the children of Ohio?
And ECOT is the ninth largest school. If that 15,000 full-time enrollment holds up, you know, that makes it the ninth largest school district in the state of Ohio. And with a graduation rate around 40%, you know, I mean, ECOT will tell you that their non-traditional students sometimes, you know, have a lot of work to do in terms of coming from difficult backgrounds and you know, educational challenges and whatnot. But still, that's not a good number.
Weren't there new laws then put into place, though, because of what happened with ECOT? Didn't the state upgrade their regulations for charter schools statewide?
Oh, no question. And that was a bit controversial, but it did take effect about a year and a half, 2 years ago at this point. ECOT's not hit those yet. They've not been deemed to be a failing school, which, you know, makes you wonder what else is out there.
I mean, how much you have to fail in order to be failing?
Well, quite frankly, I mean, some of the smaller ones that don't get the attention or publicity because they're not nearly the size of ECOT, but there's some schools out there that are really failing their children and failing the parents that presumably out of hope, maybe out of desperation, turn to them and they've fallen short. Now, again, I'm sure there's a share out there who are doing great things for kids, and that's what makes it so hard. It's hard to, you know, the public school, traditional public school advocates want to just sweep out all charter schools, all bad. And, you know, with ECOT as a exhibit number one, there's a big case to be made for that. Ohio legislatures and Governor Casey came back and says, well, let's regulate them a little more stringently and let's try it that way. So we're still kind of in that phase of working things out.
Has anyone else been subjected to this kind of not just scrutiny, but by the state legislature that they're not following the law? I mean, we hear about ECOT, but
online schools that the audits are either done or in process of being done. So, yeah, the concerns about ECOT are concerns that the Department of Education has about other online charter schools, and they won't get as much attention as ECOT just because they don't have as many kids, but still there are worries about those.
We're going to have to wrap this up, guys. Thank you so much for being here. and helping me on my first day. Yeah, we appreciate that a lot. I want to thank our guests again, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Daryl Rowland, Columbus Dispatch public affairs editor, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thank you all for joining me again today.
Thanks, Gail.
Thank you. I may see some of you next week, too. Yeah. All right. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.